Welcome back to Current State. It's 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Spartan basketball's next two games are both at the Breslin Center. We're up against Northwestern on Thursday evening. It's Nebraska Sunday afternoon. Tough loss yesterday in Madison, 60-58. And Maurice Cheeks will be freezing soon, along with the rest of us, since he is off the Detroit Pistons' hot seat. Mo Cheeks fired yesterday as the Pistons limp along at under 500. Later this hour on Current State, we learn about a new Lansing theater company, Ixion. Jeff Croft, its founder, joins us, and economist Richard Vetter on what he feels is a higher education bubble. Also, jazz musician Omer Avital on the way on Current State. We're glad you're along. In his 2012 re-election speech, President Barack Obama vowed to make voting easier for millions of Americans. This came after reports that many had to wait in line for hours at polling places to cast their votes. Last year, President Obama appointed a bipartisan commission to look at what improvements could be made to our voting process. The Presidential Commission on Election Administration just released its 112-page report late last month, and in it are recommendations to improve a variety of things, including access to polls, voter registration, polling place management, and voting technology. Christopher Thomas was one of the 10 members of the president's panel, and he's been Michigan's director of elections since 1981. And he joins us now to discuss the report's findings and voting in Michigan. Welcome to Current State, Chris.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
After serving on this commission, how did you come to feel about Michigan's performance?
I felt very very good about Michigan's performance. A number of the proposals and recommendations in the report, Michigan is already well on the way or has accomplished. For example, we use electronic poll books that we put out. Election officials, which we have great election officials in the state, all speak very highly of that. It's moved their process along, which is great. And of course, we were the inventors of Motor Voter, where you can get your voter registration done when you're doing your driver's license activity. And ours works. There's only a couple of them in the state that really, in the country, that really do the job the way they should. And Michigan is one of the two. And that really keeps the polls in good shape on election day with accurate records. We have very few provisional ballots as a result. We've been working on poll workers, training with them and videos to help them where they can access those at home, get refresher courses. And we are also belong to this interstate cross-check, which is 26 states are involved. We work on the integrity of the voter registration system by swapping records, looking for people who are registered in more than one state and getting them cleaned off, and the few numbers that actually vote twice in one or in two different states. It happens very rarely, but it does happen on occasion. So on the whole, I was very pleased with a number of things that were brought up that we heard in hearings around the country, that Michigan is well out in front.
Sounds like a unique opportunity to get a better bead on what happens elsewhere in the country.
No question. As you noted, I've been at this for a while. And when I go out on these hearings, I learn stuff all the time. I mean, it's fascinating what is being done in other states, how they've worked their systems to make them more user-friendly to the voter, increased integrity. So I've always learned that way. It was a great opportunity.
One of the main things we can do, you suggest, is to implement online voter registration. Why?
That's correct. That's a great way to hand back to the voters the opportunity to become registered to vote, and more importantly, is to keep their file up to date. Now, we've partially implemented this in Michigan because we have one very unique factor that no other state has. And in Michigan, your driver's license address and your voter registration address are the same. So when you change one or the other, it will change the other. So if you change your driver's license address, it's going to change your voter registration address.
And so, how many states, are we in a minority of states that offer online voter registration?
Well, there are 19 altogether, and we're not full online yet. We are only for people changing their driver's license address who are already a registered voter. They can go online, and when they change that driver's license address, it will change their voter registration. But we want to take the next step, which is to allow anyone who is not registered and has a driver's license or a personal ID card to come into the system using the online system.
And if we're partially implemented, how far along are we on a 100% scale? How far along
are we? I would guess probably about three-quarters of the way. About three-quarters of the transactions are changes of address each year, and about a quarter are new registrations coming in. So in other words, new meaning new to Michigan. So we've got good experience with it. It's the Express SOS program that Ruth Johnson's put in for the driver's license system, and it's a great way to keep your record up to speed.
Are there security issues associated with that, though?
No, actually, you will put some data in that you don't put on a regular paper voter registration record. For example, you're going to put last four digits of your Social Security number. You're going to put your eye color. You're going to have your full driver's license number. These are all this has to coincide with your data that's on file in order for you to even get into the system. Whereas a paper voter registration system, there's no audit trail to that. Anybody can fill out anything on that and mail it in, and you know, then it becomes part of a process of verification. But I would argue that the online actually offers more security.
What about actual online voting? Is that on the horizon?
Likely not in my lifetime, and I expect to live a long time. It's been bandied around, but until the security issues can be resolved, I really don't see it coming online. I think the voting will follow commerce and whatnot. I mean, we've seen enough problems in the commercial arena with files being hacked. I know Yahoo a week ago got hacked. I'm a Yahoo user and had some unpleasant experiences as a result of that. So I don't see online voting any time in the near future.
Why isn't security a greater concern with regard to the registration, though?
I think it would become the targeting that people would have. In other words, those that want to disrupt a system, focusing on election day or the period before, and putting those creative energies they have onto that system. Whereas a registration, not only would we require those data elements, but we would send a letter then to both addresses to tell you that that occurred. So the voter would have full knowledge that they did change their registration, and if somebody happened to get in, they would be able to correct that.
We're talking with Michigan's Director of Elections, Chris Thomas, who is one of 10 members on President Obama's recent Presidential Commission on Election Administration. They just submitted their report last month. What about absentee voting in Michigan? Currently, you need to have a reason to file an absentee vote, correct?
You do. And this is a trend that no reason absentee is a trend around the country.
What do you make of that?
Well, it's been proposed here several times and really has not gotten any traction in the legislature in terms of mail-in, no-reason absentee balloting. Now, with our current system, we're at about 23% of our voters in a presidential year vote absentee, which is a pretty sizable amount. Ruth Johnson's actually come up with, I think, a very astute compromise, if you will, which is leave the current system the way it is, so none of that will be taken away, and then offer any voter the right to vote absentee in person with ID at their clerk's office. So you could stop into your city or township clerk, apply for your absentee ballot right there. They would give it to you. You could take it home, mail it back in, or you could go mark it and hand it back to the clerk at that time. So that would offer everybody an opportunity, if they wanted to vote before the election, to get that done. and it would provide the same security that we have on Election Day, which is voter ID.
You alluded to hang-ups in the legislature here, and this does become an incredibly political process. What's the holdup in political terms on the no reason absentee voting?
Well, I think that when people talk about voter fraud around the country, the only place you really see any incidents of it of any significance is in the absentee area. Where we've seen that in Michigan has really been usually in local elections. It's usually a fight over City Hall. The turnouts in local elections are usually much lower, so sometimes the absentee ballots are 30-40% of the turnout. So we've seen a lot of folks out kind of shopping with voters who've gotten their absentee ballot, sometimes a little harassment, if you will. And there's been a variety of other schemes of attempting to collect absentees and voting those outside of the law. So absentees, you know, once you leave the sanctity of the polling place, we can pretty well guarantee that you're going to have a good experience there. Once it's out in the community, then that's the opportunity for mischief.
You say Michigan needs a new voting system. Why? What's wrong with the old system?
The system works fine right now, but like any technology, it's not going to last forever. You know, you go buy a computer now, and after 3 to 5 years, it starts to, even if you're not using it a lot, it deteriorates. We're ahead of that game. We've had our systems now out there for 10 years. They're optical scan systems. They still work. So we're looking to move forward to the next generation. There's a group of election officials that have come together to take a serious look at what the next generation will look like and to get that process rolling.
What would that allow us to do?
Well, what it's going to be is something very similar. The voters, the next generation of optical scan goes digital. Right now it's all light bar, which is a tougher technology to maintain. The digital actually takes a photo of the ballots as they pass through there. I think there'd be a lot better system in terms of operating within a polling place. It won't jam as often. They've got some high-speed readers that will be used for absentee ballot processing. It'll be a nice technological step forward.
How much will that cost, and does funding this become a concern?
Well, it's like everything. It's not cheap, but it's become more reasonable. Likely a statewide system would be somewhere between $50 and $60 million. Last time we bought, which was the first time we've ever bought statewide, we had Help America Vote funds, and that was a law that Congress passed after the Florida debacle, and they provided $3.2 billion to states to purchase new voting systems. We spent close to $70 million on the system back then. We've done a great job with our stewardship of the Help America Vote funds. So we do have some of those funds left, not to fund an entire system, but at least half of the system.
What did you make of the Supreme Court's decision last year to alter the Voting Rights Act?
Well, that's a tough area. Michigan, we've got two preclearance jurisdictions that were covered. And it was kind of a quirk that they were covered in Michigan because the unit of coverage is at what level of government do you register voters.
Mm-hmm.
We do it at the city and township level. Most states do it at the county level. If ours had been a county level, nobody would have been covered. But we had two small jurisdictions, Clyde Township in Allegan and Buena Vista in Saginaw, that did, for Spanish speaking, become pre-clearance jurisdictions. That did require us to pre-clear with the Department of Justice all of our election laws and procedures prior to implementation. So we did that since the 70s, and we're no longer required to do that under that court's decision. So the court really looked at the formula that was developed back in the 60s for African American, and in the 70s for Spanish speaking that affected us, and they basically said those are outmoded formula. And you really need a more current formula, which is what Congress is working on today.
Is addressing issues like these a state issue or a federal issue? What should it be?
Well, I think typically it should be a state issue. That's where it's supposed to be. And only when things get so egregious as they were in the 60s is it necessary to bring the federal government in. I wrote an article recently for the Michigan State Bar Journal. And from my teachings, I also teach at Cooley election law course. It was a very interesting time period back in the early 1900s, which really doesn't get taught very much in school. And that's in the South. After the Civil War, the registration and participation by African Americans was nearly equal to white voters. And I'll give you an example. In Louisiana, they had 126,000 white voters and 127,000 black voters. Mm. And during the period of late 1890s to 1910, all these southern states changed their constitutions to put devices in to disenfranchise African Americans. So that 127,000 black voters in Louisiana went down to 406. Mm. And it really was not until the mid-60s when the Voting Rights Act passed, mm-hmm. that was remedied. Mm-hmm. So when situations like that occur, it is certainly the federal government's duty to step in.
And why overall, Chris, don't voting issues receive more attention from lawmakers compared to education, transportation, all of the issues that we hear about all the time?
Well, there's been a number of activity over the last decade in the legislature that has made improvements to our system. While they haven't been the real splashy news items, like consolidation of elections, for example, where we've gone from elections almost every week somewhere with special elections for school millages or whatnot to really just four election dates a year. In our general election ballot, if you look at that, while it's very long, the voters do have an opportunity to vote on school districts, townships. Now cities are moving there. so we've increased the participation in terms of those offices. So there has been work being done. It's hard to do work in election years.
What are you looking at between now and November? I mean, what are your priorities here heading closer to the election?
Well, our priorities are not so much legislative as they are really planning and making sure that our 1,500 cities and township clerks and 83 county clerks are ready to go on election day. And there's a lot of training that goes on. We work with them and their associations. That is really the focus right now.
Is it more challenging than it used to be? I mean, you've been at this gig for a long time.
Yeah, it is. There's more lawyers involved, so that always makes things challenging.
Enough said.
Enough said.
We want to thank our guest, Chris Thomas. He is the state's director of elections and was a member of President Obama's Presidential Commission on Election Administration, which recently released its report on how to improve our nation's voting process. Chris, thanks for joining.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Jazz bassist and composer Omer Avital will be at Wharton Center's Paysant Theater with his band on this Wednesday. Avital's music includes literally a world of influences from Israel to Spain to Africa to America. Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke to him last week and began by asking him what he listened to growing up in Israel.
I think a big variety of styles, I would say. I guess what you could call Israeli music, which is varied, you know. I listen to traditional Middle Eastern music, liturgical Yemenite Jewish music, Spanish-influenced music, a lot of American music, including jazz and just popular songs, everything kind of radio. Later, classical music, when I started studying classical guitar.
You were born to Yemenite and Moroccan parents, and I think Americans tend to be a lot more familiar with the music associated with Ashkenazi Jewish culture, like klezmer music, you know, from Central and Eastern Europe. But your background is Sephardic, which has ties to the Middle East and Spain. And if you could just let our listeners know kind of what are some of the elements of Sephardic music?
My families are from Yemen and Morocco, and it's basically, over there, Jews over in those countries had their specific traditional music, although in most cases it's basically the music of Yemen or the music of Morocco. I mean, there's a vast, very, very large tradition of liturgical music in Morocco, for example, or North African Jews in general, Algeria and Tunisia as well. It's just pretty huge. I mean, basically, it includes the classical, what they call Andalusian music in North Africa, which is supposedly it's been Jewish and Muslim, originating in Spain of the 9th or 10th or 11th century, as well as any popular styles in North Africa, which are connected to the rest of the Arab world. You know, in the 50s, everybody listened. Once radio was part of the culture, everybody listened to Egyptian music in the Middle Eastern world and North Africa, too. It's pretty big. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to cover. In Yemen, it's a little more specific. Yemenite music is a little more, I wouldn't say narrow, but more specific to the region. Jewish people had their own musical styles within that genre.
I'm sure our listeners can hear that there's some background noise. That's because you are in
Brooklyn right now, New York City. Walking around, we have to live with the noise here.
What inclined you to start playing the bass?
I started with classical guitar because we had a guitar at home. And then I went to high school. I started as a classical musician, but I was gravitating towards pop, rock, whatever was around, you know, electric instruments, keyboards, anything that was a little more loose. You had people and kids playing jazz, and I was very mind blues and very much attracted to the style, the fact that they were improvising, the feeling in general, the sensation of that music. My dad bought me an electric bass when I was in a band. And then I had basses, acoustic basses, lying around in my high school because not too many people played them. So I picked one, I took one home and started playing it. And pretty much immediately it was like, yeah, this is my instrument. This is what I want to do.
You liked the improvisational quality of jazz and blues.
Yeah, for sure. But also it was felt to me like a very uplifting music in general and celebratory even. And I liked that. It was a big challenge to improvise. And, you know, the more I got into it, you realize it's a huge world. And once you're in, you're sort of hooked on it.
You've got a band coming with you to the Paysant Theater, some saxophones, a pianist, a drummer. What kind of people and skills do you look for when you're putting together a jazz ensemble?
At this point, I mean, it's been a part of my growth. You know, it's like your family, your friends, your extended family. Luckily, I had the good fortune of growing up musically around the best musicians in New York City. And we've sort of established these amazing connections over the years. We're playing, traveling, playing in each other's bands, having many, many experiences together. And I still have these amazing connections still today, you know? So what I look for, I mean, in general, you know, good musicians, strong improvisers, people that are I guess in general, people that are rooted in those traditions, you know, and love the feeling of jazz and blues, are knowledgeable at the same time, are open to try to do it a little different. I think most of those decisions are made instinctively. It's like chemistry, you know, it works or it doesn't. You know, these people that I'm bringing, are coming with me, are some of the best in the world. I'm very, very happy and lucky.
Tell me a little bit about your new record.
The new record is, scheduled to come out in March in Europe, and it'll be out in the States this summer, I believe in August. It's called New Song, and I'm happy about it. You know, I think it showed some of the evolution of my music and my band over the past few years. It was a very good recording.
How would you compare the jazz scenes in Europe and in America?
What I consider the jazz scene is New York City, which still is sort of the center. You know, it's different. Everywhere, the beautiful thing about jazz, everywhere you go almost, there's a jazz scene. There's jazz people, jazz musicians, jazz lovers, some clubs, some associations, some, you know what I mean? It's very, very cool. In Israel, where I'm from, there's a lot of great interest in jazz, in Japan, Italy, everywhere. Obviously, France and Paris. So it's just different everywhere, but it's kind of interesting to see that it's like a family scattered around the planet.
What do you ideally want people to experience when they listen to your music?
Something they haven't experienced before, maybe. Being in a familiar place, but experiencing it in a new way. So hopefully they feel that, and I don't know, feel happy. You know, that's what I would hope. That's what I feel. When I play my music, when I write, and the reason why I'm doing this, because jazz is definitely about transmitting that feeling and the sensation almost.
Well, I sure appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And
thank you. I apologize for the city of Brooklyn for its noise and disruption.
Without the city of Brooklyn, there would probably be no jazz. So all is forgiven. Yeah. Omer Avital, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Thanks for joining us on Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. We're also online at WKAR.org, and you can email us at currentstate@WKAR.org. We've all heard stories of PhDs who work as janitors or sales clerks. Increasingly, we've also heard of professionals who owe tens of thousands of dollars on their college loans and of recent college graduates unable to find work at all. These trends are altering the long-standing conversation about the value of a college education. According to our next guest and others, they're all symptoms of a higher education bubble that's postponing, if not derailing, the dreams of millions of college graduates and their families, and slowing economic growth in our country. Dr. Richard Vedder studies these issues as director of the nonprofit Center for College Affordability and Productivity at Ohio University. Dr. Vedder, welcome to Current State.
Glad to be with you.
I touched on some of the better-known features of what you'd refer to as a higher education bubble. In your view, why are these things happening?
Well, we've devoted a lot of resources to higher education in recent decades, and we've told students, of course, prospective students, that to be a success in life, you need to have experience in higher education, preferably obtaining a bachelor's degree or more. And all of this, you know, is well intended, and some of it is even good advice. But like anything else in life, the law of diminishing returns applies, meaning that if you get excessive about doing something or overdo it a bit, you may find out that the results turn out differently than you intended, and that they don't have you don't get the payoff that you expected. So we simply have too many people going to college and getting degrees for the kinds of jobs that are available that the college students traditionally expected to get. So the jobs that college kids are getting, graduates are getting after they finish, in some cases are far less well-paying, involve less skills and so forth than what they expected. So there's a gap between the expectations of students who go to college and what they actually get after they graduate.
You've been warning of this bubble for several years, at least. Is this situation worsening?
Well, it's a problem that, yes, it has been building over time, and it's worse today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. It's no question that the Great Recession following 2007 aggravated the problem and accelerated this mismatch in labor markets. But it's been going on for some time. If you were to go back to, say, 1970 or 5, hardly any taxi cab drivers had college degrees, less than 1%. Today, maybe 16 or 17% of taxi cab drivers have college degrees.
Huh.
And so it's been building for some time.
Could this bubble burst like other market bubbles?
Well, it can burst in the sense that you get outcomes that are not expected, and that is happening. So in that sense, it has burst. It won't burst in the sense that, for example, I don't think we're going to get a dramatic decline in the price of college. You might have gotten a dramatic decline sometimes in the price of stocks, or housing prices fell a lot after 2007. You're not going to see the price of college falling dramatically, I think. But even there, you're starting to see some effects as more and more people are starting to ask themselves, well, maybe I shouldn't even go to college, or maybe I should defer going to college. And we are starting to see a little bit of that. Enrollments in universities are leveling off, maybe down slightly this year over last year. And some think that we may be beginning a something of a modest, if not dramatic, decline in college enrollments.
Hmm. What do educators, what do politicians need to address to improve this situation?
Well, there's this imbalance between those wanting to go to school and those in the job market. I think we need to do a better job of counseling students in high school and even earlier to say that something to the effect that all students probably should think that they need to do something after high school to make themselves marketable and trained to participate in the world of work. But that is not necessarily a college degree. There's other options out there. We may need to expand vocational programs in high schools. We may need to increase trade schools and vocational schools, training people to be electricians and plumbers and welders and things like that. We do need those kind of people still. Those jobs are not bad pay. In fact, some of them pay quite well. And we need some people to go into those professions as well as into the kinds of white-collar jobs that most college graduates aspire to.
Universities in this country, I mean, they all invest in recruitment and promotion and marketing increasingly. What I have to ask what your discussions are like with university presidents and university faculty and the like.
Well, it's interesting. It's amazing the proportion of comments I get from faculty that are positive, that agree with me. I'm sort of, in a sense, a contrarian. I'm a college professor myself. By the way, I'm in my 49th year of teaching college, so I've been around the block a few times. And I've gotten some hostile comments from both university presidents and professors. But the proportion of comments that are favorable is quite high, particularly the private comments from, say, university presidents, the ones that, you know, they don't want broadcast what they said specifically. But a lot of them will privately admit that there are a lot of problems out there. There's something of an academic arms race going on, which is sort of forcing schools to spend, at least schools feel they're being forced, to spend more and more money offering more amenities to students, trying to hire superstar professors to give the schools the marketing advantages and so forth. There's a lot of what economists call non-price competition going on that's very expensive, and a lot of university presidents are frustrated by the fact that they're being sucked up into this, what I call academic arms race.
You've said that as a country, we need to re-examine why the government is quote, in the higher education business. What do you mean by that?
Well, if we had had no government involvement in higher education, particularly, say, the federal government in the student loan programs and the Pell Grant programs, say, over the last 40 years, we'd probably have fewer people going to college now. And so there would be that. Some people would view that as a negative factor. But we would probably not have 115,000 janitors with bachelor's degrees today either. We would probably not have as much of this mismatch between in the job market. We would probably have fewer dashed expectations where students expect to get a rather nice managerial job and they end up doing something which pays much less. So there's been a lot of, we wouldn't have as much, we wouldn't have the huge student debt problem that we have. So we might have 25% of Americans with college degrees instead of 30% or 32%, which is what we have. We might have a little less, but we would probably have a little bit lower dropout problem. That's another huge problem we haven't addressed. Nearly 40% of students who start college don't get a degree even in 6 years. I'm talking about a four-year degree. So some of these problems would probably be less, and maybe so we may want to re-examine the way the government funds education, or even whether it should fund education. Maybe it only should fund the very, very poor who truly need financial aid in order to make it.
Do you hear people contend that even if a college education doesn't result in optimal employment, that the larger society still invariably gains through many more well-educated citizens?
Yeah, that argument is prevalent and is commonplace, and it's no doubt true that college graduates have a lot of desirable, let's call them social characteristics, that are positive. They're more likely to engage as volunteers in civic activities, for example. They're less likely to smoke, which reduces problems with secondhand smoke, etc. They're less likely to commit crimes than those who don't go to college. Now, there is some debate, however, to what extent are these favorable characteristics a consequence of actually going to college, and what extent do they reflect the fact that the people that do go to college and graduate are by and large the more responsible members of society anyway. Even at age 17 and 18, they were more responsible. They were better high school students, for example. They were less likely to be picked up on drug or drinking charges even at 17, 18 years old. So how much of it is the actual college experience and how much of it is other things? And there's, you know, some debate on there. There's some literature that does suggest that the mere presence of college graduates helps non-college graduates perform more productively and in their job and so forth. So there is some evidence supporting that idea, but there's some evidence that is also that doesn't support it. So the evidence is a bit mixed on that.
Do you think American families with high school students, for example, are they becoming more aware of what you're talking about here?
I think, yes, there's been a rather dramatic change in the last 2 or 3 years. I've been studying this issue fairly closely for the last decade or so, and at first I would say there was a very dim awareness, a limited awareness. I think that has grown a lot because of a lot of publicity about the student loan debt problems, stories of college graduates unable to obtain good jobs, and so forth. So I think the problem has grown. I think the awareness, and I think this is a good thing. I think things are improving in that regard.
Dr. Richard Vetter is the director of the nonprofit Center for College Affordability and Productivity at Ohio University. Dr. Vetter, many thanks.
Thank you.
A Lansing theater veteran is starting up a new theater company. Jeff Croft was the founder of the former Icarus Falling Theater Company. Tonight he launches Ixion Theater with the first of three staged readings of The Four Disgracers. Croft has asked four playwrights to write one-act plays inspired by ancient myths. Tonight's reading of the plays is at 6:30 p.m. at the Capital Area District Library, downtown Lansing branch on South Capitol Avenue. Ixion Theater Artistic Director Jeff Cross joins us here on Current State today, along with one of those playwrights, Alex Freeman. Jeff, Alex, good to see you.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Sounds exciting.
We're excited.
What's the idea behind the Ixion Theater Company, Jeff? Is there an overriding theme in play here?
The inspiration for Ixion actually stems from the Icarus story. We were down at the DIA a couple of years ago and encountered some engravings by a Dutch engraver from the 16th century. And he had four engravings called The Four Disgracers.
So, Hendrik Goltzius.
Yes.
The Dutch 16th century Dutch engraver. And what were the engravings of?
They were engravings of four mythological figures, Ixion, Icarus, Phaeton, and Tantalus.
And you have four new one-act plays inspired by these engravings. Alex Freeman, how did you get involved with Ixion, and what did you like about taking on this theme?
I met Jeff a while ago doing an Icarus show, and from there I've lived around the country and just kept in touch with him. And then we were talking one night, and he said, "Hey, do you want to write something for me?" And I said, "Sure," and I ended up with the Icarus myth, which is felt really nice and sentimental of Jeff to allow me to write the Icarus myth, because I know it means a lot to him. And
you would seem to have quite a connection to the classical world, classical literature, classical plays.
I do. I mean, my friend Daryl Thompson and I, who created Icarus Falling, had always really enjoyed mythology, study of it, and so on. So it's I think they've got themes that inspire or transcend time to be stories that are relevant even today.
And Alex, which one did you tackle?
I tackled the Icarus myth, and it was,
And remind us what the Icarus myth is.
Icarus built or created wings of wax and tried to fly off of an island prison-type place and flew too close to the sun.
Ah, yes.
And his myth is often held up as a reminder of, knowing your limits.
Hubris.
And, yes.
Right?
And
is that it?
Okay. In my piece, I take a different approach.
Can you tell us any more about that?
I hold up the idea of flight, of dreaming of flying, as being more divine than keeping in mind your limits. Because there's no there's no fall if you never take the risk. Mm. And so if you never take the risk, you're not going to get anywhere.
But there's no forebodings about flying too close to the sun. Is
no,
that it?
Yeah.
That's a little less a part of your treatment.
Yeah, and one of the notes in one of our earlier meetings is I've taken a much more realistic approach to the myth, as opposed to actually he flies and gets close to the sun. He really just kind of takes a header off of a cliff, is what
to put it in contemporary terms. Yeah. Yeah. Jeff, is your aim with these one-act plays to expand them for future full-length productions, or what?
No, we don't anticipate these would be expanded. I really enjoy the short-form theater idea of one-acts, and you don't often get a chance to do that in the Lansing area. So it's one of the things we played with Icarus Falling, and it's just something I really like as an idea to kind of launch something new. We get so accustomed to a two-hour show. There's a 15-minute intermission at the center. Everyone gets to a certain pace. The one-acts play around with that. You don't have that complacent expectation as an audience member. You have to kind of see what's going to happen, what's going to go on. We've got shows or plays that are going to run probably 4 to 5 minutes, and we've got some that are going to run almost 20. So it's kind of fun because you don't have that preset expectations and laid-back kind of expectations.
Where will this take place?
Well, we're still working on a space here in Lansing area. The full production will go up in May. But we're doing these staged readings to prepare and develop the scripts and let the audience actually get a chance to look behind the curtain and see how the process really works.
And where are the staged readings, though?
Staged readings. There's one at
Capital Area District Library.
Library.
Answered my own question.
But there will be one on MSU's campus on the 24th. We're in the MSU Theater Building in room 12 as well.
But you are searching for a home for Ixion Theater.
We are. I've developed a bad habit of liking to use alternative spaces, so we're going to continue that trend and see what options we have around Lansing.
Is Ixion going to be a professional company with paid union actors, or more of a community amateur company?
I'm going to hedge and say it's a hybrid. We won't be a union house because we honestly, as a fledgling organization, can't afford all of the constraints that has. But we will be paying our performers and participants per performance or for the run of the show.
Alex, are you a full-time playwright? Is this something you juggle with other professional responsibilities?
Sort of. I currently coach a lacrosse team, actually, as part of my jobbing around of things that I do. And I write and I act and direct and just kind of gig it in the art world.
Who do you think the audience will be for Ixion shows, Jeff?
Honestly, Lansing has a really vibrant theater community, and I think it's going to be folks who've gone to other shows, whether it's out to Williamson or into Riverwalk or even Remember Boar's Head, to people in a larger regional area that are just interested in something different and something new. Mm-hmm. Theater offers something that you don't get out of film or TV. That interaction and community of experiencing theater is different than any of those others.
Part of your background includes directing family-friendly shows like Annie. Will Ixion shows be for the? Will some Ixion shows be for families?
They will run the gamut. Our next season, which we will be announcing when the Four Disgracers goes up in May, but has some family-friendly fare as well as some shows that are going to be a little bit more challenging. One's a Pulitzer Prize-winning play, but the language for that one will be a little rougher.
Hmm. Alex, did you get to know the other playwrights involved in the other three?
I did a little bit. It's been an interesting process. I always am intrigued by how other writers work.
I'm sure.
Because it lets me know that I'm not as crazy as I think I am. and sometimes it tells me I am as crazy as I think I am.
Who else did you line up, Jeff?
We've got other local writers. One's moved out to Boulder, but Brad Rutledge is out in Boulder, but he's a local favorite actor and writer. We've got Aralia Garza, who's done theater in Lansing for a number of years here, and then Sarah Hoke, who's also had a work produced at Lansing Civic Players, as Aralia. So it's a great chance to bring local playwrights together and go through the development process for a new work.
And what is Ixion? Who was Ixion?
Well, Ixion's myth is actually Kind of rough. Actually, not necessarily a figure that
the ancient world was pretty rough.
Well, I think Ixion was rougher than most. So his myth itself is problematic, but he ended up betraying Zeus's trust when he was brought to Olympus and fell for Hera. Now, Zeus, of course, wasn't terribly thrilled about that, regardless of his philandering ways. And so he tricked Ixion and created a cloud version of Hera and confirmed his suspicions, and thus cursed Ixion to a life of spinning on a wheel of flame.
Aye.
Yeah, I know, not such a great thing. But the Goltzius' Latin inscription of what he took from it, and actually it's kind of what inspired this whole idea of being inspired by art, warned against hubris. It warned against taking yourself too seriously and overreaching. And I think it's a good advice for actors who, especially in this day and age, are often elevated to godlike status and are far, far too human.
Do the other three playwrights, Alex talked about contemporizing his myth to some extent. Mm-hmm. Do the other three contemporize as well? Or
It's, again, a mix. We have one that stays very much in a dinner party hosted by Tantalus. But then we have others that have become a mob story, with very contemporary roots, and then another which becomes kind of an otherworldly contemporary take where Phaeton and Helios have a bit of father-son issues going on.
There were mobs in the ancient world. In fact, you could say the entire ancient world might have been one big mob.
Or hordes, even, really.
To tell you the truth. Your former company, Icarus Falling, what was your approach there, and what's happened to Icarus Falling?
Shuttered about 2 years ago. Icarus Falling was started by, as I mentioned, Daryl and I, to really offer challenging works. We felt that, one, that Lansing at the time had about 20 different theater groups going on within 20 minutes of the Capitol. Mm. And we felt that we could offer some spice or some seasoning to the other shows, which we thought were kind of safe or less challenging. So plays that had adult themes, plays that were one acts. Again, you don't often have a chance for that. And so we shuttered it, really just felt it had run its course. It was time. But after 2 years, it's time to start something new.
Staged reading scheduled for tonight, 6:30 p.m. at the Capitol Area District Library, downtown Lansing Branch on South Capitol Avenue. It's Jeff Croft. Ixion Theater launches tonight, and one of those four staged readings belongs to playwright Alex Freeman. We look forward to hearing about more of your exploits in the future with Ixion Theater. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Watch Aristophanes take a header tonight at the Lansing Area Capital District Library. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, there have been many complaints and legal battles in the Great Lakes region centered on wind turbines. Some people claim that turbines make them sick. Tomorrow, an audiologist weighs in on the debate. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.